there's a clear connection with what happens to poor people and people of color in the southern U.S., as well as what happens on a global sense with the South. And that's the exploitation.
Hello, and welcome back to the Climate Bridge podcast. My name is Mary Helmick, and I am an analyst at the Berlin-based climate policy think tank Adelphi, where I co-lead the program office of the Transatlantic Climate Bridge, the initiative behind this podcast.
Hello, and I'm Kira Schrödel. I am board member of the Young German Grassroots Think Tank on Foreign and European Affairs, Polis 180. Besides my volunteer work for Polis 180, I'm currently pursuing my master's degree in international affairs in Berlin and Washington, D.C. Together with Mary, I'm hosting today's fourth episode of the Climate Bridge podcast.
The goal of the Transatlantic Climate Bridge and of the Climate Bridge podcast is to promote climate policy cooperation between Germany, Canada, and the United States. Stay tuned through the end of the episode to learn more about the Transatlantic Climate Bridge.
In this episode of the Climate Bridge podcast, we will discuss environmental and climate justice in the United States and Germany, as well as their efforts to address environmental and climate justice at the international level.
The impacts of environmental degradation and climate change disproportionately affect disadvantaged communities, who suffer the most from, among others, poor air and water quality, extreme heat, and rising sea levels. For decades, the environmental justice movement has been fighting for equal protection and equal enforcement of environmental laws and regulations for all. Work that is more relevant than ever as we now experience impacts of climate change. Today, we have the very exciting opportunity to speak with two individuals working to build environmental and climate justice in the United States and Germany. Dubbed the Father of Environmental Justice, Dr. Robert Bullard is Distinguished Professor of Urban Planning and Environmental Policy and Director of the Bullard Center for Environmental and Climate Justice at Texas Southern University. He is also co-founder of the National Black Environmental Justice Network and has authored 18 books on environmental justice, making him one of the most cited authors on the subject.
And we are also joined by Nora Löhle, former program director for the Environment and Energy Program of the Heinrich Böll Foundation in Washington, D.C. She just joined the German Federal Foreign Office as an advisor for the Climate and Security Department, where she will work to shape Germany's new climate foreign policy. And with that, let's jump into our conversation with Robert and Nora.
Robert, you've been working to put environmental justice on the map since the late 1970s, when you assisted a lawsuit that revealed that although Black people made up just a quarter of the population of Houston, Texas, the vast majority of harmful landfills were located in predominantly Black neighborhoods. Since then, you've worked to build up the environmental justice movement and make it a prominent issue in United States politics. Could you tell us how you define environmental justice and describe how the movement evolved from receiving little to no attention when you started in the field to today being high on the White House agenda?
Well, actually, the issue of environmental justice was not even a term or a concept when I was drafted to work on a lawsuit. It was 1979. Linda McKeever-Bullard, my wife at the time, asked me to assist in conducting a study and doing a report on where all of the landfills and solid waste sites located in Houston, Texas, from 1979 up until from the very beginning in the 30s up until 1979. And I had 10 students in my research methods class at Texas Southern University, and I told my students, we have a project students. And so designed a study, and the long and short of it is that it was doing ancient research. There were no Google, GIS, no iPad, iPhone, laptops, none of that way back then. But we were able to show that the pattern of who gets dumped on is not random, and that much of the determinants as to who received these facilities was race. And when you look at during that period of time, from the 30s up to 1978, 82% of all the garbage dumped in Houston was dumped on Black people, even though Blacks made up only 25% of the population. Now, that was an eye-opener for me as a sociologist. And so during that whole research endeavor from 1979 up to 1985, we got no help from the environmental community, the green groups. We got no help from the civil rights organization. So it was like there was no idea of what this was that we were doing. And so we're uncovering. And so it took more than a decade before the civil rights community and environmental community converged on this issue. In 1979, environmental justice and environmental racism was a footnote. Today it's a headline. What is it? Environmental justice embraces the principle that all communities and people are entitled to equal protection of our environmental laws, regulations, and policies. No community should receive less protection just because it's poor, just because it's physically located on the wrong side of the railroad tracks or the river or the levee, or happens to be a community of color. It's very simple. Environmental justice is a basic human right.
Yeah, thank you very much, Robert, for already giving some insights on your point of view on environmental justice. Before we proceed, I think it's very important for us today and also our audience to clarify a little bit more some terminology. The Climate Bridge podcast is a podcast on climate policy, and today we're discussing mainly environmental justice. So, Robert, can you tell us how you understand it precisely the difference between environmental justice and climate justice, as well as the interplay between the two movements?
Yes, it's very simple. Environmental justice is the overarching term theme that captures a great deal, including climate. We could resolve the climate crisis and still not address many environmental crises that impact communities, such as poverty, such as racism, such as issues around land use and dumping of poison and pollution that really may not necessarily be climate issues, but also are injustice. So what we have that the environmental and climate justice movement really need to take into consideration the convergence of those issues. And just because we're working on climate change means that if we are to have a true, healthy, resilient, sustainable world, we need to also address these other issues, such as housing and transportation and access to healthcare, those kinds of issues. And gender justice issues, reproductive issues. These are all issues that are embedded in our climate justice work, as well as our environmental justice work and our economic justice work. So it means that it's a big tent that we are under. So it's a lot of room and a lot of work to go around.
Yeah, thank you very much for that. Now to turn to Nora. Also, as we're a transatlantic podcast, we want to extend our view a little bit beyond the United States border. Nora, you're originally from Germany, but have been closely following the environment and climate discussions in the United States and around the world. How do you understand the relationship between international climate justice and international environment justice? And how are these movements playing out in your home country of Germany? Are there differences? Are there similarities?
Thanks. I will add, really liked and appreciated Robert's point already to give us a clear idea that talking environmental justice is way bigger than just solving environmental issues and challenges, right? Like, and I love the way how you described it, that this has to do with racism, equality, like access for everyone on the same level. So I love the idea to just repeat that environment should really be seen as more than just the biodiversity, right? Or the clean environment create or hopefully maintain. I'm going to try to start off, find a little bit the differences between climate and environmental justice. I would start with saying that I think I see a tendency that environmental justice, to me, in my observation, often is something more seen locally within a community or a region and also tackled as such. And with climate injustice or justice, I see more often effects which really reach a global effect and impact. So a doing by a certain country often then has huge effects in a very different regions around the world. I will say though that you can clearly make that point because it's not always true. And when I started thinking about, again, asking us where's the difference between the two, I was going to give an example in my home country, Germany, like an example where I would say that's mainly an environmental justice issue, which is air pollution has been a big issue in my home country for a long time, mainly caused by the transport sector. So combustion engines from cars and trucks. And we have cities, actually my home city, Stuttgart, has had the worst air quality measurements in the last couple of years within the whole European Union. And we actually by now got a fine because there is EU regulations which define how bad air quality can be. And we are reaching way over those values. And so now we have to pay fines because we are not within the regulations given by the EU. So again, I would say that's foremost an environmental issue. Again, it is something very local. It happens in a region where you have a lot of traffic. There's technologies, combustion engines, which create this bad air quality. And then we see the phenomenon that lower income households happen to be affected, especially when talking about their health situation then, which then causes a lot of health issues for people living in those regions. And it happens to be many more low income households because they happen to live in apartments, which are usually located around bigger streets where there's more traffic, and households which have higher income can sort of separate themselves from that issue by locating their housing because they have the choice to choose where they locate their houses, where there's no traffic at all, less traffic. So there is this environmental injustice when looking at air quality. But then, of course, I thought further, and the truth is, not only do the cars, the combustion engine driven cars, cause this bad air quality, they also contribute to climate at the end, right? Because they also emit different emissions. So they also contribute to climate change. So there, again, there's the interlinkage then talking also climate change. And that climate change we are contributing to then has bigger effects around the world again.
Thank you. Yeah, it's so useful to see how these topics interact with one another and how, yeah, improving one can improve the other. But it's important, I think, to tease out that there are key differences between these two as well.
I had a point that clarifies our environmental justice as we develop our principles of environmental justice, really speak to those 17 principles and the overarching principle of environmental justice is the right to self-determination. And the extent to which global international models of development have been exploitive, north-south. In many cases, we don't even have to deal with climate. We're dealing with economics. We're dealing with extractive industries. We're not just talking about climate-related, but also the justice-related in terms of the imbalance between what's taken out of the ground in the global south and what's left: pollution, degradation, poverty, illness, and death at the expense of making the North, the global North, wealthy, healthy, and in a sense, much more livable and sustainable. Now, I haven't even touched on climate. I'm talking about environmental justice. And so when we developed those 17 principles at the First National People of Color Environmental Leadership Summit in Washington, D.C. in 1991, it was a U.S. summit, but we had six representatives, delegates from the global south that saw the connection, what we were doing in the U.S. in terms of poor people and people of color basically being somehow placed at a disadvantage when it came to who reaps the benefit from extraction and from development, and who pays the cost, and the and in terms of the externality. Our environmental justice framework, as I said before, when we developed those principles in 1991 in Washington, D.C., when we went to the Rio Earth Summit in 1992 in June, we took our principles. Those principles had been translated into six languages. And those principles that we developed around environmental justice, the foundations of the climate principles, those principles coming out of dealing with climate change from a justice standpoint at the COP6 in The Hague in 2000, we developed the first climate justice summit. Those, the climate justice, the environmental justice leaders, organizers, and some academics developed that summit. So there's a clear connection with what happens to poor people and people of color in the southern U.S., as well as what happens on a global sense with the South. And that's the exploitation and seeing that imbalance not being addressed. And we'll see that at every COP meeting. It's the fact that the COP meeting that will be held in Egypt, COP27, will have a lot to do with issues around loss and damage, climate finance, reparation. Those are really issues that resonate not just from the climate impacts, but for those economic exploitation, colonial, imperial models that have somehow made the global South poorer and sicker and less sustainable.
Thank you for making that point. I think it's really critical to focus on as the world is embarking on this green transition. It's not just, are we doing it? It's how we're doing it. Are we going to follow those same extractive colonial structures that brought us this problem in the first place? So that's a great point. Thank you. And we're going to turn to the international landscape a little bit later in the episode. But now I want to talk about the United States federal level. So the Biden administration is making climate and environmental justice one of its top priorities. Shortly after taking office, President Biden established the Justice 40 initiative, which prioritizes 40% of the overall benefits from federal investments in climate and clean energy towards disadvantaged communities. And then this past summer, Congress passed its largest piece of climate legislation in history, the Inflation Reduction Act, or the IRA, with $60 billion of the bill's $370 billion earmarked specifically for environmental and climate justice. Now, of course, the success of the environmental justice measures in the IRA will ultimately depend on their implementation. And there is already some concern that the Justice 40 initiative designates 40% of the benefits of federal funding, not 40% of the investments for disadvantaged communities. Robert, how would you like to see the justice measurements in the IRA implemented? And how can the administration ensure that the money actually gets into the hands of those who need it the most?
Well, let me just preface my remarks by saying that I serve on the White House Environmental Justice Advisory Council. And there are 26 members of that council, many of us coming from environmental and climate justice communities, racial justice, civil rights. And we have been fighting for the kinds of legislation that's passed Congress. That's what we voted for. And outside won. We won. So it means that we have to still fight to make sure that the wins, the resources that have been put forward, whether it's the $1.2 trillion bipartisan infrastructure law, or whether it's the Justice 40 initiative by the Biden administration that talks about benefits. And we have been saying for almost 2 years that those benefits need to somehow be made into measurable dollars, metrics, so that we can actually see where the money is being spent on communities. The bipartisan infrastructure law has historic dollars with a B, billions for clean energy transition, $60 billion for environmental and climate justice. We've never had that kind of money before. So what we're doing with a number of our organizations and our institutions, like the Bullitt Center is a partner with many of our organizations that are on the ground that work on environmental and climate justice, working to ensure that we have the kinds of tools, scorecards, measures, and building capacity with our nonprofits and our community-based organizations, our organizations that are led by women, led by organizations that historically have not gotten any money to do this work, but have been doing great work. Now there's resources for this. And so we are now, we have collaboratives that are working together in a very collective way, community university partnerships, nonprofits, networks, to really drill down and track the dollars and not end up a year from now or 2 years from now with all those billions spent and our community still being left out. We will not rest until we make sure that money follows need. And historically, as I've mapped the federal dollars path of how that money generally flows, federal dollar is money follows money, money follows power, and money follows whites. In this case, we're talking about money following need and to ensure that we take advantage of long overdue resources that historically have been denied to our communities, tax dollars that have been denied to taxpayers. So we're ready, we're up to the task, and that we're excited that this administration is putting this money where its mouth is, not just talk, walk. No, I've been doing this for 40 years. We don't have 40 years to get this right. Climate change is on all of us in terms of urgent here in the U.S. as well as around the world.
Yeah, absolutely. It is the time for implementation, whether we're talking about local level or UN climate discussions. There's no time for anything else.
Thank you both for these very helpful insights. Unfortunately, we're almost approaching the end of our conversation. So with that, let's turn back to the global landscape. Nora, you already discussed that climate justice is also a critical issue in the international climate policy arena. The European Union and the United States are among the largest historic emitters of greenhouse gases. And while we certainly already see the impact of climate change in those countries, small island states, for example, are significantly more affected but have contributed the least to the climate crisis. Nora, we have just heard about how the United States is addressing environmental and climate justice domestically. How are they doing beyond their own borders? And what are the opportunities for the United States and Germany or the European Union more broadly to work together on climate justice internationally?
Yes, I definitely think there is lots of opportunities, especially for the US and European countries to work together. First of all, because we do share this joint responsibility we have. As you just mentioned, both of our continents, countries have been the biggest emitters, including Canada also, right? I would add that sort of to the US. So there is lots of opportunities. And honestly, there's no other question that both of us, we have to do our goods. And Robert already mentioned that. And that's a good development. I think we are seeing in this COP coming up very soon now in Egypt, we will see a very new topic within the international climate community, which is called loss and damage. So countries who are already way bigger affected by climate change, again, mainly caused by the United States, Canada, and Europe, now are actually losing the future of living where they have been living for now. They have to probably resettle, find new livelihoods, and so on. So they are now bringing, in addition to the table, the whole question of how do we, in a more just way, talk about these serious issues that we are facing, our future being jeopardized, right? And that brings us back to which has been existing for quite some time now, the international climate finance, where, again, the countries who mostly contributed to climate change have made big promises to offer funding. Obviously, that is, I will say, not the only tool, right, to face climate change and do better. But obviously, countries who are already affected, and plus, it's always important to mention international climate finance is also meant to help those countries, which also happen to be often poorer. So generally, global southern countries, again, they are already affected heavily by climate change, happen to have more poverty. climate finance is meant for them also to play their part, because they want to also contribute to the climate targets, right? So it's both. It's a justice tool to help them deal with the climate change effects, but also play their role in being more climate friendly in growing their economies. So there is this whole promise, but unfortunately, none of the countries, so again, the Western countries, have contributed the amounts which were promised. And to give an example, unfortunately, in the US, we have just seen Congress pass the bill on this year's international climate contributions. They agreed to give $1 billion this year. Initially, there was planned to give $11.4 billion. So this is more than 11 times more. So that show, and again, we see similar developments. Also, European countries are also lacking of paying their full amounts. That's not how we deal with this. Again, there's huge impacts. Look at a country like Pakistan right now. A third of it got flooded. A main reason for those increased floodings is climate change. And they are facing no access to food right now, like the worst and horrible health issue to that flooding. And people can't do the farming they did to have their livelihoods. So there's like several big questions on how people can still live in that region and how they can actually live a just living. So climate finance needs to be stepped up. There needs to be more funding, along with, again, technologies which can help. And also we need more emergency funding and emergency reaction by especially the US and European countries stepping in when we see those climate emergency crises happening.
Yes, I agree. I agree with everything you said. And I was in South Africa a week and a half ago. We had a gathering of NGOs in Southern Africa, and that the issue around climate finance and the issue around loss and damage and the issue around some type of larger fund, that $100 billion that was promised per year was U.S. was just a promise, and you can't spend the promise. In some cases, they're saying $1.25 trillion at minimum for Africa alone. For the first time in 26 COPs, there will be a climate justice pavilion on the blue side, on the government side. And there are three organizations, U.S. organizations, that are making it possible for that global climate justice pavilion: the Bullet Center for Environmental Justice, Environmental and Climate Justice at Texas Southern, the Deep South Center for Environmental Justice in New Orleans, Louisiana, and we act for environmental justice in Harlem, New York. Our three organizations raised the money for this pavilion, and I suspect that our pavilion will be a magnet for a lot of concerns and programming that have not come about because of empty promises. And again, that imbalance of responsibility versus vulnerability, that imbalance is creating havoc, as you said, in Bangladesh, in East Africa, creating climate refugees, creating cross-border conflicts, creating health problems, and in some cases, potentially destroying the cultural and the livability of place and people. And so those are issues that you just can't say money can replace that. You can't replace a culture, or you can't replace people's lives and livelihoods, but that needs to be some additional funds going into that pool of resources that's commensurate with the problem and the challenges, and not think somehow that we can delay, and because communities that are flooded, that are losing their homes, that are sinking into the ocean and the seas, they can't wait, and they have contributed least to the problem, but they're feeling the pain first and longest. That's environmental and climate justice. That's economic justice. And we need to address those issues with the urgency of now. And the United States should be a leader. And we're glad that the U.S. is back in the game, but we still have a, a long way to go when it comes to signing on to some of these policies and plans that we see as just because of our contribution in terms of greenhouse gases and global warming.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think we're all excited to see specifically the loss and damage in the climate finance outcomes from COP27 in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt. Nora, did you want to jump in?
Yeah, I just wanted to add, hearing Robert talk, I think it's beautiful to see that within, again, the environmental groups around the world, there has been so much more connection over the years and exchange on strategies, on the different challenges each community faces around the world, which also then has created more solidarities. Like, you can totally hear within different environmental and climate organizations, they are raising more also, again, the global perspective, the injustices created around the world through like several countries the most. And I think seeing that gives me a lot of hope. And I think we just have to hold, again, our governments accountable that they do the same, that we see this solidarity within different nations. And again, we have created the United Nations for exactly that reason one day, right? And Robert started our talk about how environmental issue is actually talking about human rights, right? So we should, again, create way more this global solidarity of how to fight climate change jointly, but also acknowledge who is causing the damage and has to step in and do their goods, and then we can succeed. And I also want to add this point that it's one thing to offer funding and support and acknowledge responsibility and having caused damage, but I think we should also bring in a whole new culture of how then climate projects and the fight of climate change is done, and acknowledge that many communities on the local ground know much better what to do in each region. So this climate finance should also come with the understanding of the concrete action being done by communities, so local-led action. So less defined on the big multinational level, which projects get approved, right? Local communities usually know very well what they need and what can be done in each region, also considering the environment and the culture in each community.
That's a really fabulous summary. And I think perfectly encapsulates the whole mission behind this episode, to give a reflection on how lessons learned in throughout the years of building up environmental justice in the US, how these lessons play out, not just in the context from which they emerge, but actually around the world, going up to the highest levels of international governments like the United Nations. Thank you, Robert and Nora, so much. I can't thank you enough for taking the time to speak with us.
And now for one of our segments, there's a German word for that. We will discuss a word that one of our guests today described in English. We know English speakers love long German compound words. And the word today is Luftqualitätsgrenzwerte.
Okay, let me try this. Luftqualitätsgrenzwerte.
Wow, that's pretty good.
Pretty good? Okay.
Yeah.
So I can see a few words merged all together. Could you tell us what they mean and the context in which this was used in English during our interview?
Yeah. So as you mentioned, there are several words inside, and they're precisely Luft, which is equal to air, Qualität, which is equal to quality, and Grenzwert, which you can translate as like a limit value or like a limit, whether it's retained or broken. So in today's interview, Nora talked about it when he described an example for understanding environmental justice in her hometown, Stuttgart, Germany. As she mentioned that Luftqualitätsgrenzwerte describe the value of air quality, and they also can be more precisely used to define the standards of air quality, for example, in an EU regulation.
Okay, very nice, very efficient, and very German. And now for our final and my personal favorite segment, Climate Policy Crush. In every episode, we share a climate policy measure in another country that we would like to see implemented back home. Let's hear from Robert and Nora about the measures they wish they could see implemented in the US and Germany.
Yeah, I'd like to just say that I'd like to see electrification of transport here in the US proceed in warp speed and emulate a lot of the connectivity of Europe and the trains and being able to move around with ease and not be so automobile dependent. You would solve a lot of issues. You would reduce the amount of greenhouse gases, you would increase mobility, accessibility, and the economics of people being able to get to places who don't have cars. I'd like to see that. That's what I've been working on for many years, and I wrote a couple of books about that, just transportation.
Awesome, thank you. As an American living in Europe, I still get really excited every time I train anywhere because this is not something that we have in Minnesota or in Texas. So I completely agree. Nora, what's your climate policy crush?
So I'm then going to pick a way, let's say, smaller project, which I just gotten to learn when I visited in the summer Medellin, a city in Colombia. And I was very impressed seeing a city where there's a lot of construction going on. They are growing as a city. It's a beautiful, lush, green environment. But again, it becomes a very big major city. And there's lots of high-rising buildings. But it still seemed rather green. And I was positively surprised. And then a local told me that there is a regulation in place which defines that whenever a new construction is done, no matter which kind of building, they have to fulfill a certain amount of greening when doing that construction of a building, which then led to this whole innovation. So again, because of space limit, that city is really going into more high rising buildings. But at the same time, because they have to fulfill like planting certain plants, a certain amount of plants, they came up with very innovative ideas how they green those high-rise buildings. So you see a lot of, let's say, bigger balcony pots put outside of the surface of a high-rise building with like not just a few flowers, but real like plants, like palm trees, like shooting out of that high-rise building. Because again, right, the idea is they can't afford having a whole garden in front of that building, but they use the building to green the city. And I think it's important. So first of all, I felt myself as a visitor, it like a lot of green makes you feel much better, more healthier. And it's really pleasant to be in a city like that, modern, but at the same time, still very based on nature and plants. But we also know plants, of course, reduce air pollution. They can be very helpful with locations where there's a lot of rainwater. They are like absorbing the water. The soil has its effects. So it's a whole round biodiversity at the same time, like coming up with very modern buildings. So I really like that.
Wow, that sounds amazing. It sounds beautiful. And also, of course, green spaces help reduce the impacts of high heat. And as we know, communities that suffer the greatest heat-related preventable diseases or other impacts are mostly disadvantaged communities. So what a perfect wrapping up to the episode. If you're still listening, I'm sure you want to learn more about the Transatlantic Climate Bridge. Adelphi and its partners run the TCB with the support of our funders in the German federal government, and our activities include writing analysis, putting on events, facilitating government dialogues, organizing exchange programs, and much more. To find out more, please visit our website at theclimatebridge.org and follow us on Twitter at climate_bridge. That's it for our fourth episode. I'm Mary, signing off.
And I'm Kira. Thanks for listening. And bis zum nächsten Mal.